Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. We're back here in 1954 with our pal Charles Schulz and his buddy Charlie Brown. And today we're going to go through the best, the first, the funniest, the weirdest strips of 1954, continuing from our last action-packed episode. I'm Jimmy Gownley. I'm the cartoonist of Amelia Rules, The Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up book, and my memoir, The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me, as always, are my pals and co-hosts. We have the composer for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast, and the cartoonist behind such great strips as Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells, Michael Cohen.
Hi there.
And executive producer and writer for the hit TV show Mystery Science Theater 3000, as well as the former vice president of Archie Comics and creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
All right, guys, we have so much left to talk about in this great year of 1954, so how about we just get right to it?
Why not?
Great.
May 9th. This is a series of Sunday strips, the first ever continuing story in Peanuts. And it is the infamous story we have been teasing since probably the first episode of Lucy at her first golf tournament. I'm not going to read the individual strips, but what I want you to do is pause this podcast, go to gocomics.com, find these strips. They start on the Sunday of May 9th, 1954, and they continue for the next couple Sundays. Read them and then come back, because I think we're going to have a lot to say about this little story, including maybe some nascent conspiracy theories. Who knows? All right, so you go do that.
We'll cue the Jaws music.
Okay, now you're back. Okay, so guys, so we have Lucy at the golf tournament. It breaks all kinds of Peanuts rules. The most obvious being that there are adults drawn in this strip for the first time in this manner anyway. It's a continuing story that doesn't really have a gag or the feel of the other Sunday strips. It's just really, really different.
It sure is. And we should say that the adults, he never really puts a full face on any adult. Well, just for those of you who didn't follow our advice, there are heads in the last strip of the four strips in this little series of adults. And I think the closest you get is one guy has like two eyes. They're kind of creepy looking because they're incomplete drawings. They're like shadows of human beings or just. It's like the idea of a crowd is that you often see in a painting, but he's making sure he doesn't show you details on a human being, an old adult human being.
Michael, what are your thoughts on this?
Horror. Yeah, it doesn't work on so many levels. I mean, first, if Charlie Brown is a golf expert, just doesn't scan.
Yeah,
I don't think we've seen him playing golf.
Well, listen, when I'm the emperor of cartoon land or whatever, my first decree is I would ban golf strips. When the cartoonist reaches for the golf strip, it is the most bourgeois nonsense. I cannot take it. And I played golf. I played on the high school team. My dad was a great golfer. Golf comic strips. Oh, ugh.
Yeah, there never was a golf comic book, was there?
Sure, the Japanese have them.
No, I bet there is.
Yeah,
in Japan, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
So there's a couple of things. Not only are there adults, when they draw the main characters, Charlie Brown and Lucy, interacting with the adults, the kids are tiny. They look like Smurf height in some of these panels. So three apples high.
This is just a huge error, and I can't understand why he would do it. I mean, a man who's like the most popular cartoonist in the world probably by this time would go, oh, I think people are going to want sort of this drama of continued stories, and they'll be looking forward to the next Sunday. I can't see Schulz thinking that way.
Well, I mean, we know that Schulz really did enjoy those adventure strips, though, and he enjoyed basically every type of strip, apparently, except for superheroes. And So I can kind of see why he would want to take a crack at this. He'd want to, you know, and we see that little strip before we were talking about. He's Charlie Brown is making a human interest strip, and he's interested in making a human interest strip, and he's, you know, in classic style, he's being rejected by anybody who ever shows one of his ideas. But, yeah, you know, the idea that Schultz was thinking human interest strip, what if I could do a human interest strip? How would I do it? What would it look like? How could I make this work? He's doing it here. And I kind of find it, I'm so grateful that he tried, you know, I'm so grateful that this is here, because it's kind of crazy, and it's annoying because Schultz does not put gags on this. And even the final gag is not particularly great. So
there is, you know, no gag.
Yeah. And everything is like continued. Next week, Lucy plays in her first golf tournament. Four.
Yeah.
You know, he's really trying to sell it with these little, you know, to be continued things, the way Al Capp used to do on his Sunday strips with the little Abner. You know, the idea that you got this extended continuity that specifically you are supposed to check out, you know, wait 7 days from now, because you're going to get more of this exciting episode. And yeah, it doesn't work, but I wonder if Schultz might have grown into it if he had did, you know, this is just four strips, you know, would we be fawning over Charles Schultz's human interest strips if he had done another 300 of them? I don't know.
Yeah, but he's not using his characters here. I mean, this is not Lucy. Lucy, and we know she's good at jump rope, but she's, I mean, to imagine her as like a tournament level golfer who's only like 1 foot tall, it just doesn't make sense. It goes against everything. Charlie Brown also seems to be an expert. Schultz is letting his love of golf, maybe that's it. He just really, really wanted to do a golf tour.
Yeah, it's weird.
You know, the other thing about this is, though, especially if you look at May 30th, right? There are drawing choices that are completely antithetical to anything he has done at this point. If you look at the second panel, Lucy, it looks like cubism. It looks like Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. She's occupying a space, like a plane, that a character has never done before, with Charlie Brown framed in the lower right, just visible from the head up. Harold just was talking earlier this episode about how we rarely see that. It's usually just the full-on shot. And here we have him, not only a close-up, but he's leaning ahead in the picture plane. It's completely different. Then that's followed by a three-quarter bird's eye view of the entire fairway with all the little, you know, people out there golfing and the people watching it and stuff like that. Again, like nothing he ever drew before. If I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say that there's somebody else's hand here, like Jim Sassoville. Because that doesn't look like that doesn't look like Lucy. And the other thing that I find interesting about it, Michael pointed out how beautifully drawn and well observed Patty was when she was batting. Well, Lucy's not holding the golf club right. She would break her wrists if she golfed that way. Someone who golfs as much as Schultz, it would seem, would know how a golf club is held. And he does that mistake in a couple of the Lucy golfing things.
Can you give an example, Jim?
Not off the top of my head, but if you look at some of the non Sunday golf tournament Lucy's, you just look at her when she's driving. A lot of times, if you see her hands, they're crossed, and you really couldn't do that. It would really hurt yourself. I don't understand how Schultz would make that mistake. He just wouldn't make that mistake. Look at how he draws the scores of Beethoven. It's pretty weird. Could this have been?
But he does break the laws of physics.
It's sometimes. Not intended. It's not intentional. It's a mistake.
You know, it's a mistake. It's like what you think.
No, I don't think it's a mistake. It's a mistake. I mean, there's no way. It's.
Would someone talk about the comic book at this point? Because you mentioned Sassoville.
That's what I was just about to say. Could this be a pitch or an attempt at a comic book story that is then retrofitted for the Sunday?
That was my theory. That was exactly my theory. That he was trying to make something that could be sold to United United Features comic, because United Features was publishing their own comics. They had a bunch of them, like Tip Top, Sparkler, United. So there was a space where they were reprinting his dailies and coloring them, and then later his Sundays, which were already colored, and they were just cutting and pasting and moving them around. And I bet at certain times Charles Schulz was upset with some of the ways they might have to realign things and this and that. And he was like, wait a second, you know, I'm alongside some other strips that do have some continuity, and they're giving me multiple pages. Maybe I can get more pages. Or, you know, that was all my theory was, yeah, he's seeing his stuff in comic book form. He does have a lifelong love, like Buzz Sawyer. I think all these strips he would mention that he enjoyed. Here's his chance to try it himself, and then maybe it could grow into something else. It's not successful. It's not successful, I think, from an entertainment standpoint. It's what I think Schulz ultimately did with this concept is he actually did do human interest comics. He actually did do it, but he did it in a way that was so good we don't think about it much. He gets into these continuities that usually lived in the dailies, and often the individual gags are not that strong. As Snoopy goes on a skating competition with somebody, or with this or that. He does do it, but he finds a way to do it that's not so jarring, and it's truer to the characters and truer to his style and what his audience has come to expect. But he does kind of move into the human interest things. Remember Snoopy in the doghouse with the icicle that's above his doghouse? For some reason, the doghouse is next to the house for some reason, for the sake of the story. Right. Again, he's breaking rules of the continuity of the characters, but it's more of a spit time and space thing and not a characterization thing like it is here, where you doesn't add up to the characters we know. But you know, there's real drama in some of these strips. I think we could all remember strips that went on for weeks. Linus's blanket going out over the was the Pacific Ocean or whatever. I mean,
Linus and Lucy moving away at one point. Yeah.
Oh my, yeah, yeah. And he nails it then. He does get to use some of his interest in human interest story and drama.
Well, can you define what do you mean by human interest when you say that? What's your definition?
Well, you know, I think of, like, to me, a human interest story is a human interest comic is a non high drama comic that might be like a Mary Worth or something, where it's, we're talking about the lives of individuals. Gasoline Alley might kind of fall into that category in certain years, where it's, the stakes are not super high. We're interested in the way we might be in a soap opera. We're interested in how characters are relating to other characters. It's not life or death usually. With you know, like a Terry and the Pirates, where people are fighting a war, it just has a kind of a slice of life element to it that, you know, that he's doing in comic form, humor form now, and now he's just trying to say, well, how can my characters work in this other world where I'm not necessarily trying to make people laugh every day, but I'm getting them involved in a story, a plot. You know, again, I think this is not a good choice of his. You know, he was trying to do something that was probably visually different in interest. I think he was very interested in drawing ways he had not drawn before. You know, that aerial view you were talking about, Jim, where everyone's approaching the green and people are far, far away, and he's using these very stick figure-y, almost long distance character shots. There's a lot of love in those panels. He's putting a lot of effort into doing something unique and different and showing off an aspect of himself as an artist that we've never seen before, and really don't see much again until we see what he did in sketchbooks and that sort of thing, and that were not intended for print.
So is that all we have to say about the golf tournament?
Let's pretend it never happened.
May 26th. Violet and Charlie Brown are standing talking. Charlie Brown has a bag in his hand. Violet says, I like potato chips. Charlie Brown says, that's good. Just hold out your hands. He proceeds to pour some potato chips into Violet's hand. Whoops, she says, you spilled one. Don't worry, says Charlie Brown. It'll never hit the ground. Panel 3, the potato chip is still floating to the ground. In panel 4, Snoopy appears from stage left and snatches it from the air. Gulp.
This is an interesting strip for time and space and what you can do in a comic strip. I mean, Schulz has the potato chips start to fall in panel 2, and by panel 4, it's fallen maybe 6 or 8 inches. And that's after they had the discussion, whoops, you spilled one, don't worry, it'll never hit the ground. And they wait and watch as it's falling. And it's absolutely impossible in real time for that to happen. It's like everything is suspended, and the potato chip is suspended in slow motion as they talk about it falling. And yet I think the strip works, which is to Schultz's credit that he understands his own medium enough that this, you couldn't do this in a movie, you couldn't do this in a novel, but in the comic strip it works.
We're starting to see Snoopy's snout growing at this point.
Yes. Yeah, Snoopy's he's finding more and more reasons to have a longer snout that helps him get a joke over.
Really nice cartooning of a dog.
Yeah, and also, is it typical for an artist when he's showing movement to show where the falling potato chip is going with little motion lines, or where it's coming from? So I feel like most people show where something was coming from, but he shows where it's going. He has these little lines that say, you see the full potato chip above two lines in the shape of the bottom of the chip. I think that's kind of unique.
I think it's fluttering like a leaf as it comes down. That's what I read it.
But he's showing the full one.
100%. Yeah, because that is exactly
on top, and then he's showing the movement lines below as if this is what's going to happen, rather than here is what has happened and here's where the chip is now.
No, I see it more as it's like a horizontal motion, like that's happening concurrently, like it's fluttering down, which is why there's the beat between the two, you know, explains the beat between the two panels a little bit, and that it's just like slowly floating to the ground.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
That's how I would do that anyway. Yeah, if I wanted it to be like it's falling, you would draw the line behind it, you know, where it's coming from. And then if I wanted to mitigate that to say like, well, it's falling slowly or whatever, I would draw those motion lines.
Is that just a subliminal thing he's doing?
He's going to do lots of leaves falling gags. That's a big thing starting this year. And let's see if he uses that for the motion of a leaf kind of.
I'm sure he does, because I'm sure that's where I got it from.
Because I'm assuming that has to be subliminal, because if this is a special potato chip, it ruins the gag. He's saying any potato chip can't survive falling when Snoopy's around. But it's subliminal that if you put those lines
above it. Yeah, it's not special.
If you put the lines above it, then people would be thinking it's supposed to hit already. It's supposed to hit already. I'm seeing the thing move down. And if you have it underneath, it doesn't have that feeling. It does feel like it's kind of suspended in the air like a leaf.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. June 1st. Linus is sitting in the foreground, a blanket clutched to his cheek. Charlie Brown says, "Why does Linus hold his blanket like that?" Lucy answers, "I'm not sure. I think maybe it gives him a feeling of security." Lucy walks while Charlie Brown walks away. Then she finds him, his own blanket pulled up to his cheek, a much larger blanket. He blushes and says, "It doesn't work. I feel like an idiot."
He just introduces like one of the major things in any comic strip ever.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, well, I think I'll have him suck on a blanket. I mean, the joke doesn't matter, but it's the fact that that blanket, I mean, just becomes a thing everybody in the world knows about. I mean, a security blanket is just...
And it's specifically associated with security from the very first.
Yeah, he nails that from the beginning.
Because the term security blanket was not a thing.
Depending, what do you mean by that? I mean, it was out there. People did say it, but he certainly made it, right? He made it popular. He made it part of everyone's conversation.
Right. June 6th. This is a completely visual gag. Charlie Brown flying a kite, and everybody is sort of doing their own thing. Lucy is jumping rope with the girls. Shermie has Snoopy out on a leash for a walk. Schroeder is running with a balloon, and they all get entangled, I presume, by Charlie Brown's running with the kite. And the last panel is just them all askew on the ground.
This is so cinematic. I could see this as a 5-minute cartoon. A soundless cartoon.
Yeah.
And yet the biggest motion, the biggest event happens off screen. We see the aftermath. You know, it's almost like you'd have to, I don't know what you would cut to, or would you actually, does the gag work if you actually see all of this happening, or you have to see the aftermath somehow? You know?
Oh, I think it's the cut. It's the fact that you don't see it. It's the fact that, like Michael said, every one of these is a very well-conceived, well-composed shot.
Yeah,
that it does feel like you're editing from moment to moment, And then the surprise of not having the climactic moment, just seeing the aftermath, is what makes it work as a joke.
And it makes it work as a comic. I totally hear what you're saying about it. This each shot looking cinematic.
Oh, but
yeah, but this could only work in comics.
No, you couldn't actually edit this to get the same punchline. You would have to cut to like a sound effect or something. You know, that would, because you can't. It wouldn't make any sense to not have. You'd have to have some representation of the crash if it was animated.
You'd probably have to have an extra panel of this kite dropping out of frame.
Right.
And then you cut back to that. You'd have one extra shot or something.
Yeah, but you'd also have a score. Yeah. Here's how you'd score it. Charlie Brown would have a little theme. Lucy Jumping Rope would have a little theme. And then in the end, they're all playing at the same time. There'd be like a big cymbal crash.
Michael, I think you just gave yourself a
an assignment,
a little project that you need to share with us, because that would be absolutely amazing. The crash in Discord. That's really cool. That would be great. So if you Unpacking Peanuts fans want to hear that, first off, you should follow us on our social media, Twitter and the Instagram. We're Unpack Peanuts on both of them. And go there, and you'll be able to vote on stuff, and you'll be able to see what we're up to between episodes. And now we'll be able to wait for Michael's composition.
It's coming.
Yeah. And the very next week's strip is also a kite flying strip, a Sunday strip, that is. And it's the one that I remember the most as from just my childhood memory of Charlie Brown with his brand new kite that he's put together. And then he's bumping it on the ground, the trees, and just totally tearing it apart as he's running along, just keeping running and running and running, trying to make it fly. And the last panel, he's carrying a string, which is flying in the air with no kite, and Snoopy looking at it up at it with a question mark. I remember that strip so vividly from my childhood.
It's amazing how some of them just become a part of you. And it's hard to say why some of them are. It's just they hit you at that exact right moment. June 8th. Charlie Brown is watching television. Violet is behind him. She says, "You're a hopeless case, Charlie Brown. Nobody respects you because you're a flop, a complete flop." She walks away. Charlie Brown says, "Miss Francis likes me," pointing at the television set.
Google that.
I propose the obscurities revealed or something like that. For strips that were so of their time, and 99% of people reading it today, certainly young people would have no clue what they're talking about. And this would be one of my two nominees for this year.
Peanuts, Obscurities Explained.
Miss Francis. So Miss Francis had a show. It was the earliest preschool show, predated Romper Room by a year. And Miss Francis was this lady who would talk to preschoolers about how to do crafts and arts and sing songs. And it was a very big show. Started in 1952.
Not in LA. Not in LA.
What's that? What did you have?
Because, well, this is the year where my age pretty much corresponded to the characters' ages, because I was four.
Yeah.
And I never heard of the No Miss Francis.
It was an NBC show. It was on, I think, 5 days a week in the mornings or something. And then she was Miss Francis, the lady who played Miss Francis was an educator, and she was super stickler, kind of like Schultz was about things. And she finally ticked off NBC when she wouldn't let them advertise BB guns on the show. They let her, she quit essentially. And then I think she went into syndication a couple years later and lasted till like 1965. So she had like a long, long run, and they published like 25 books. I have some of them actually. And 11 records, and there were like 30 different manufacturers making all these ding-dong school products. So, you know, Schultz in his household was walking past a TV set that had ding-dong school running.
I remember ding-dong school. I just don't remember Miss Francis.
Oh, yeah. Well, she was ding-dong
school. Was that hers?
Yeah, it was her.
Oh, well, I remember the name. I think I did watch that.
We had Hatchie Malachi.
Hatchie?
Shout out to Miss Judy. Yeah, live show, hour and a half every weekday out of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Wow, just out of Wilkes-Barre.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah, and they played like old underdog cartoons, and she would do crafts and stuff. It was great. Great show. June 20th, Patty approaches Charlie Brown. Psst, Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown walks over to her. What's up? There's a big grin on Patty's face. She whispers something to Charlie Brown, who whispers something to Violet, who whispers something to Schroeder, who whispers something to Lucy. Lucy asks, why? Schroeder asks why back to Violet, who asks why back to Charlie Brown, who asks why back to Patty. Patty whispers something to Charlie Brown, who whispers it back to Violet, who whispers it back to Shermie, who says to Lucy, because. And Lucy says, oh.
That's a lot of panels.
A lot of panels and no rulers on the panel borders, completely freehand.
Yeah, rounded corners.
Yeah.
So they're playing a game of telephone. The idea being, of course, that whatever it started as often isn't what it ends up being. In this instance, it's just that the information being conveyed is relatively pointless, right? Because telephone, it's not to just say why and because, it's because it would get mangled and the end result would be very different than the first thing the person said. This is just an inefficient way to communicate with people. This is what we had before we had social media. You would have to talk to people. Thankfully, we're past that. June 27th, Charlie Brown is sitting at what looks like a beach on a lake. He's playing with a bucket of sand. Snoopy walks up behind him, looking very happy. Snoopy runs right at Charlie Brown and leaps over his head. He frolics for another four panels before slamming down on the ground. Wham! And Charlie Brown carries him home in his wagon. Snoopy looks a little bit dazed from the experience. Charlie Brown says, "You're the only person I know who can use up a whole day in 5 minutes."
This is another good case of the snout growing. Snoopy's becoming a little more pliable. And that panel on the third tier, that's not an expression he's used before. That smile. And this is something Snoopy starts doing more often when he's imitating people. He goes through this phase where Lucy's sitting there and Snoopy will come up and imitate her. So he's able to have like a human smile there, which doesn't make sense for a dog.
Yeah, and Snoopy's quite large in this strip too. I mean, compared to Charlie Brown, Snoopy is you know, kind of, if he's on his hind legs, he's as tall as Charlie Brown.
Yeah, our little boy's growing up.
That second panel, that's as good of a drawing as a dog as you'll ever see in a comic strip. That just looks awesome. Beautiful stuff. July 11th, Lucy and Charlie Brown are walking down the sidewalk. Lucy says, knock, knock. Charlie Brown says, who's there? Lucy is brought up short. She yells, fuzz! Charlie Brown says, huh? Lucy points to a little speck on the sidewalk. Fuzz! There's a piece of fuzz on the sidewalk. Oh, good grief, says Charlie Brown. Lucy says, I'm scared of fuzz. Brush it away, Charlie Brown. Brush it away. Charlie Brown kneels over to brush away the fuzz. That's the silliest thing I've ever heard. Fuzz. Good grief. Lucy yells, brush it away, brush it away. Charlie Brown is knocked back in surprise. Ack, it moved. It's a bug, he says. It's a piece of fuzz, says Lucy. They turn around. Let's go back the way we came. Lucy says, we can walk clear around the block someday when we're older. Fuzz. Brr.
Whoa. This strip was really influential in my life. It changed my life completely.
So how old are you when you're reading this, when you would have read this, Michael?
Well, it would have probably been the reprint book, so maybe it was 56 or something.
So
I might have been six.
About six, yeah. Doesn't this like reflect yeah. actual childhood trauma? I mean, this just resonates.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's so great. It's so funny. And there's no traditional punchline. The punchline is the least interesting part of the whole strip. But them just sitting there screaming, it's a bug, it's a bug, it's a piece of fuzz. I don't know. This has to be the 150th time I've seen this. It always makes me laugh.
It's great. And I also do love the end, even though it's maybe not funny, just that there's strategies to go, you know, go around the other side of the block to avoid the fuzz. I think it's very satisfying.
Oh, it's a satisfying ending. I just think it's funny all the way through that he doesn't have to put a killer punchline in the last panel because the whole strip is funny.
Yeah, definitely.
It's drawn funny. The idea is funny and quirky. The dialogue is funny. It's just, it's really, really good.
And that burr that Lucy adds at the end is that's classic also Little Orphan Annie. Burr. Some horrific thing is happening, a chilling thing is happening. It's always burr.
She uses, or Schultz rather, uses italicized lettering for Lucy in the first panel on the third tier, which is really weird. He doesn't do that very often. Gives it extra urgency and a little bit of an extra unhinged quality, which I personally like.
Yeah. And I still love his open lettering that he's using throughout this period. And certainly for Sundays he used for years. But these, they kind of like the thin ones, when he's going, ack, really thin line. It's just looks cool.
Well, it's beautiful. And it also, one of the things that interests me in lettering, which I harp on because it's one of my favorite things to do actually as a cartoonist, is that as much as it conveys sound, which obviously it has to convey story, it also is a really neat design thing. You know, this comic strip looks better because of the placement of the lettering, because of the quality of the lettering. It just adds a really nice life and design element to it. It looks great.
It does. You know, and I see in your Amelia Rules graphic novel series and in your Scholastic ones, like The Dumbest Idea Ever, you're constantly building the, I see that Schultz influence where you're building this, a page. And lettering is the art, and art is lettering. They kind of merge the way Schultz does, and it's really gorgeous.
Thanks. I mean, yeah. I mean, his example is just the high water mark in basically everything. I would also say that I think at this point it's safe to assume he is using that traditional Esterbrook pen, which I should have the number right off the top of my head.
Why don't you Google it, you blockhead?
But you know what? I will give Harold permission to Google this if he wants to. Because this drawing is like super, super facile, and it just looks great. I think at this point he's well into using that pen.
Yeah. What is that magic number he used? Esterbrook he used. Esterbrook has done a whole article on him. Yeah. It's the 914 nib. There you go. The radio 914 nib.
The radio 914.
And it's they actually have an article on it at the EsterbrookPens.com website. About Peanuts and Charles Schultz, although they misspelled Schultz's name with a T.
The T, oh, that's bad. Well, that's okay because I pronounced their company name Easterbrook, so we got him back. Take that, the man. Big pens. Anybody who is a cartoonist out there who wants to, they should try to find one of those nibs online and experiment with it. It's really fun. July 13th. Patty walks up to a kid who's playing in the dirt. We don't see his face. She says, "Hello there, what's your name?" The little boy turns around, he's covered in grime. He says, "I haven't got a name. People just call me things, real insulting things." Patty says, "What do they call you most of the time?" The kid says, "I'll tell you if you won't laugh. Pigpen."
I think this is a misstep. I mean, Schroeder started out kind of as a one-joke character. And continued that way pretty much. I mean, it's the piano and it's music, but that seemed to work. But for me, the Pigpen jokes, there's a dirty kid, and that's about it. And I know he probably stuck in the strip longer than Patty and Violet did, but I never liked this character.
Now you say you've never seen the Christmas special, right, Michael?
No.
So I think they captured the essence of Pigpen in that Christmas special, and it's the lens through which I see all of the Pigpen strips, looking back at them, because he has this sense of self dignity, and a little bit of a I don't even know what you call it, but he's like, it's almost like daring people to think less of him, and you get it from the very first strip. It's like this attitude is there where he's not what you would expect of a kid who's taking pride in being what he is, and which is something that most people find absolutely disgusting. I find there's about as much mileage for me with Pigpen as there is with Schroeder, at least by himself with his piano. I would pick Pigpen over Schroeder until Lucy shows up and starts to fall in love, and you add these other layers.
Yeah, well, you don't ever find out his real name either, which is weird. That's probably not a great sign for his depth as a character. But I think
he says he doesn't have one. I mean, are you going to take them up on that?
Oh, that's wow.
Well, Google the Grateful Dead and find out what his real name is.
That's right. He's a keyboard player, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a Pigpen agnostic. I don't think he adds or detracts from it, from my personal, you know, enjoyment of the strip. It is definitely one of the icons of the strip. I mean, there are still Pigpen t-shirts that you could buy to this day. And they're not just like the retro hipster Shermie shirts and stuff like that. They're just mass produced. You know, people know Pigpen. So on some level, it works, at least in branding. Other than that, I would agree
his
with
defiant confidence is something that I.
Yeah, well, the other I would agree with you in saying that the definitive Pigpen is Charlie Brown Christmas Pigpen.
I'm also fascinated by how all the different characters try to engage with Pigpen, because he's doing something socially so unacceptable, and every character is kind of reapproaching him with some angle, like, so do we tolerate this? Do we try to get him to change? Do we judge him behind his back? There's all these different things that Schultz is exploring with a character who has a trait that is not socially acceptable. And then that playing off of that character being aware. He's aware that they have that feeling. He's kind of the opposite of Charlie Brown, because Charlie Brown is concerned about every little thing somebody thinks of him or says about him behind his back or wherever. And Pigpen seems to be like the anti-Charlie Brown. He's like, you know, I'm aware you feel this way about me, but I just disagree. And I'm going to stick by my guns.
Right. Yeah. No, that's an interesting way to look at it, certainly. And I think it's one of those instances where I'm more interested in hearing you talk about it than I think I would actually find it if I looked in the strip. I think you have to be able to see that with Harold's eyes. Which is one of the great reasons that we have this podcast. I'm truly loving listening to what you guys have to say about these strips. And so many times I find that the parts where you're coming from a different place than me is the most interesting. So. July 25th, Charlie Brown is throwing a record like a frisbee. In the next panel, he runs past Snoopy. In this instance, he's playing... How do you even describe this to the modern reader? He has a vinyl record that he is rolling around with a stick as if it were a hoop from a barrel. He's continuing to do that. Snoopy runs up and grabs the record out from Charlie Brown's little playing with it. Charlie Brown yells, "Hey, you crazy dog," chasing after Snoopy. He tackles Snoopy. The record bends. Now they're doing a tug of war with it. Let go, I say, let go. Finally, Charlie Brown wins. Whew, what a struggle. He goes home, puts the record on his phonograph, and says, "I don't know what's wrong with these library records. They always sound scratchy." Well, this is a meaningless strip to anyone, millennial or younger, I would imagine.
No. Well, like I said, I'm contemporary with this strip. I've never seen anyone
with the stick thing. That's literally from like the 1800s. They would do it with a barrel hoop.
Except for artists who have T squares, and then that's what they were doing probably at art instruction schools.
You know what? Maybe.
But I also
Charlie Brown. That's not how you treat a record.
Yeah, this one makes me laugh out loud. I just love this. There are some of these classic strips where Snoopy comes in. We'll see greater examples of this in later years. But the Linus and Snoopy over the blanket and that sort of thing. But this one is just visually and viscerally fun. Where Snoopy comes and steals the thing and is got looking behind him as Charlie Brown's running after him angrily, and then the tackle. Snoopy's taking it. He's just kind of taking his tackle and then angrily holding on as Charlie Brown is kicking up the dust, pulling back and forth. He's really good at just kind of creating that world. And then I absolutely love the huge grin on Snoopy's face and extreme long shot as Charlie Brown walks away victorious with this totally mangled record. It's just adorable.
You use the word visceral, which I think does describe this strip, because if you look at that first panel on the last tier, that inking is really slapdash, expressive, fun inking that indicates that crash. When you go back to thinking 1953, a similar panel with Charlie Brown falling after trying to climb up the display of comic books, that was all very clean line and very delineated. And this is much more abstract and expressionistic.
Yeah, and he's picking up this cloud of dust. He's really getting into clouds of dust in the with Pigpen as well. I'm wondering if one of his kids is just driving him nuts, getting in the mud.
I think it also is just a fun thing to draw.
It, yeah, and he's so good at it. It just creating this sense of absolute filth and dust. And yeah, I'm feeling these strips.
August 1st. Schroeder is sitting out reading a comic book. He is in just his shorts. Oops, he says. Snoopy has snuck up behind him. How do I describe this? I can't describe this.
That's the gag.
That's the problem, yeah. I mean, exactly.
Well, you don't know till the end what's going on.
So maybe we don't try to explain this straight. And that is the joy of the strip for me. I think it's why I nominated it is... It's the fun of comics. You're not entirely clear what's going on based on the rules of what you can do in a comic strip, where sometimes you see a short period of time expressed over a single panel. And what's going on here is Snoopy is sticking his nose in the backs of all these kids who are essentially vulnerable to a cold, wet nose on a summer day. And but you can't really tell from the strip because they're like a foot or two away from Snoopy at the time that Schultz captures each one of these kids going eek ah why oops. You don't know what's going on until Snoopy walks away with a huge grin on his face saying sometimes it's kind of fun having a cold nose. This only works in comics and strips. It couldn't work in animation. It couldn't work in a description that's written out. It works based on the rules of comics, and Schultz knows them so well that he finds a way to do just a very unique gag very well.
And he's using that big smile, that full face smile that he just started. I don't know, maybe there's earlier cases of this, but I don't remember them. A different angle on Snoopy's face.
It's certainly far more pronounced.
It's definitely a more human face than a dog face.
Yeah, and I love strips with Snoopy having just a ridiculously big grin and him going,
August 3rd, Charlie Brown approaches Linus, who's sitting on the floor. Charlie Brown has a pack of cards in his hand. I'm going to teach you a new card game, Linus. First, I'd better get a pencil so we can keep score. Charlie Brown walks away. In panel 3, Charlie Brown walks back, whistling to himself. In panel 4, he's shocked to see Linus has assembled a huge tower out of the cards.
This is the first of a whole series. While Linus is still a baby, he apparently is a savant with playing cards and making these towers that are just absolutely impossible. And I think this carries on later as Linus is sort of some sort of genius character, even though at this point he's sort of reverted back to being a baby. We're not seeing his thoughts at all, but he can apparently do anything with anything. So there'll be several more of these.
What a shift from the Linus we've seen the previous year. Linus in the previous year constantly being thwarted. Every small thing he's not able to pull off. He puts two blocks on top of each other and they're knocked over and under huge effort. And now all of a sudden he's coming into his own. We're seeing aspects of Linus that suggest he's really very special. And it's kind of thrilling to see that.
How do you think he drew those cards? That's a really elaborate drawing. That looks like it was drawn larger and photostatted on. I mean, I have no evidence of that, but it's a really elaborate drawing for this tiny little panel.
And do you think he actually used a reference to someone who did do it? Because, I mean, can you angle cards like that? I guess you can, but man, that must be hard. I don't know if it's possible to...
No,
it wouldn't be possible. No, that has... Because that middle tier is taller than the tier beneath it. So no, you couldn't do that. But...
So that's an impossibility.
Yeah, unless you're Linus.
unless you're Linus.
Which you'll also see him doing. And actually, that when I earlier discussed the fact that he drew those portraits of the cast,
yeah.
Linus was playing with blocks, and he was building them up in an impossible way of the blocks too, mm-hmm. with the heavier part being on top.
Part of his genius is his surreal ability to do things that are impossible physically.
Yeah, as it goes on, we'll see things like square balloons and all kinds of weird things that Linus is able to do. August 6th, Charlie Brown approaches Schroeder with his new comic strip. He says, "Would you like to read my new comic strip?" He explains it to Schroeder. "It's really sort of an adventure series, see?" He continues to explain. "It's all about this fellow who rides clear across the United States on a power mower." I thought the public was interested in science fiction.
That's just weird.
No, the only reason I suggest this is because David Lynch eventually made this movie. The Straight Story.
I know. That's what I said. It's weird.
I know.
Did he know this strip?
Isn't that bizarre? Yeah. So Charlie Brown is finally vindicated. It took years.
It took decades, but boom.
It took David Lynch to vindicate Charlie Brown.
Well, David Lynch had a comic strip.
Yeah, he did. The angriest dog in the world.
Like the angriest dog in the world.
Yeah.
So he was definitely a fan.
I wonder. Makes you wonder. Do you think he read this? Had that in the back of his mind when he was?
I would think so.
I love David Lynch. As a cartoonist, David Lynch is an excellent director.
We're gonna have to let that opinion stand, I think.
August 15th, Patty and Violet are sitting on the curb. Lucy is walking down the street towards them. Violet says, "Did you know that Lucy was going to dancing school?" Patty answers, "Uh-huh. It's just one more way for her mother to get her out of the house." Violet says to Patty, "Ask her to do a few steps for us." Patty says to Lucy, "How's dancing school, Lucy?" "Fine." Patty asks, "How about showing us what you've learned?" Lucy says, "Well, I'm not sure I can remember everything, but..." She does a series of six panels of the most basic and ridiculous dance moves. Then says to Patty and Violet, "That cost my dad $12.
That's a great strip. No, I love this strip. Those little moves are so classic.
Oh, they're just the funniest little drawings. And the way he repeats them, like one going to the left, one going to the right. And that last little maneuver, which Lucy looks very proud that she's performing right after the sort of weird look on her face previous to that. It's just funny drawings.
Yeah. It's like that's the one Grecian urn, right?
Beautiful. August 31st, we just see another example of him subdividing the four panels. It's what the other thing that's really weird about it is it's Patty, but she is skipping rope and looking directly out at us. So it's a complete full-on view of her to the point that it's almost unrecognizable as Patty because we never really see her drawn that way. It looks much more like a little folks thing or like one of his illustrations from those Art Linkletter books that he did.
And I will put in my vote that I don't think she's ever looking at us directly.
No, I didn't mean looking at us as if she's trying to play to... I was just trying to orient her in space, not that she is acknowledging the presence of a reader.
Gotcha.
September 5th. Patty and Violet are sitting on the curb. Patty says, "Why should we always do what she wants?" Violet says, "That's what I say." Patty gets up off the curve and raises her fist in defiance. "Then let's tell her." In the next panel, we see they've approached Lucy. "Lucy, we've decided we're not going to play your way." Lucy freaks out. "You're not? Wah! It's not fair! Wah! Cheaters, cheaters, cheaters!" She's pounding on the ground. Bam, bam, she pounds her head into the tree. Wah! She runs off into the distance. Then she comes back and says, "Well, then let's play your way."
Essentially the same joke we pulled when she had to go to bed. It's funny.
Yeah, it is. And it, again, this would pass the Shermie test because this is only funny if it's Lucy doing it.
Yes.
Yeah. And of all the 1954 strips, this is the most iconic strip that I remember from reading Peanut strips in my childhood. This 1954 strip is the one that I just deeply feel and remember. And I think it's because I was learning something somehow from this strip, you know, that Lucy is in one place and then winds up in another. Somehow I just have this memory of there was some profundity about that strip to me as a little kid who might have been 6 or 7.
Well, unfortunately, I deeply relate to this because I know that I do this, and it's not a flattering trait of mine, or not something I want to, keep for the rest of my life. But I definitely, in my darker moments, see myself doing exactly this. And the funny thing is, you come back at the end, and it's like, all right, let's do it your way. Why were you so upset to begin with, Lucy? I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, but in yours and then Lucy's defense, I would much rather have a character who would have that minute of a tantrum and then just be, and then reset, everything's right. Fine, rather than if she kept a grudge for, 20 years.
That's my I learned that from my dad. I think he had that ability to be like, just close a chapter and go like, all right, that was 5 minutes ago. Why are we still talking about that? October 4th, Charlie Brown and Lucy are standing outside. Lucy is staring up into the sky with sunglasses on. I'm waiting to see the eclipse, she says. Charlie Brown yells at her, the eclipse? Good grief, that's been over for months. Lucy takes her shades off and says, well, don't you think I know that, Charlie Brown? I'm not stupid, you know. She walks away saying, I just thought that by this time it might be showing in suburban areas.
Peanuts Obscurities explained.
See, back in the day,
for the millennial and younger audience that's listening to this, I don't think this is going to be a clear gag. You might get a sense of it, but you won't know exactly what Schultz is referring to. You think I'm right about that, guys?
I think there's a real chance you are right. Yeah, because the joke being, it would sometimes take weeks or even months for major movies to move out of the major metropolitan areas and into the suburbs. I found out that spoiler alert for Empire Strikes Back, that Darth Vader is Luke's father from the Marvel comic. And Empire Strikes Back didn't come out in my area for weeks after the comic book.
Yeah, because they had a finite number of prints to shuttle around from city to city. And those were expensive to make. So those little towns weren't worth making a fresh print. So everybody got the same thing at the same time like they do today. When it's all digital, they can make 10,000 things and won't cost them a dime more. But back then, they only could make, 1,000 prints or whatever, and then it would play in the big theaters until it didn't anymore. And when Star Wars was running or Empire Strikes Back was running, there were some cities that would have that thing for 26 weeks before they let it go. And so the suburbs would have to wait.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking about when, this is sort of tangential, but I figured this is where you were going to go when you selected this strip. I actually pulled out the Marvel Comics adaptation that I had of that Empire Strikes Back. And it was published several weeks before the movie actually came out.
Oh, wow.
In its totality as a paperback with all the spoilers. I mean, can you imagine with all the secrecy and hush hush everything has these days?
Yeah.
And they just published an adaptation of it a month ahead of time. Yeah, I also never saw a movie probably until the late or mid 90s anyway, that wasn't completely just beat to heck, just scratched and, hairs rolling across it and missing chunks. It's just totally different color saturations from one reel to the next.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's how we liked it.
That wasn't a movie if you didn't see all that.
Well, let me say something about this strip. Lucy is such a rich character, like as opposed to Pigpen, who's kind of got the one trait. He keeps coming up with new stuff for her.
Yeah.
And they're all great.
Yeah.
Lucy here is, a whole series of strips are about basically her inability to understand how the world works. She just misunderstands everything.
And yet having strong logic.
Yeah.
She has strong logic. It's just wrong logic.
Yeah.
He's definitely inspired by this character.
Yeah.
Something she was the missing spice that it needed. Somehow the meanness of Patty and Violet, it doesn't have the depth that Lucy has that allows you to like her even when she's being mean.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about this and one of the things about Lucy that makes her a unique character that we've never seen a Lucy before, I think, is because in the past, in comic strips, lots of other strips, you might show the treatment that she has with others or the way of her way of seeing things with others, but like in the case where she's sitting by the clock waiting for it to turn 7 o'clock so she can scream bedtime to Linus, what you don't see in the strip is the comeuppance, right? She does something terrible, and the punchline is that she did it, but we're not asked to identify with her, because that was a lot of strips would either have, you know, the cruel character, they kind of wink at you and say, hey, come on and watch, we you know, Cats and Jammer Kids, the little kids are going to beat up on the big guy because he's a big guy, and so everyone can laugh when they do something to him. But here it's a bigger character, you know, older sister, and being cruel to her brother, and you see the angst and the consequence of it on Linus, and you feel for him. And it's, but he doesn't really take a side in how Schultz doesn't say, hey, side with this character. You just have to accept that this exists. And I think that's unique in Schultz, at least in his era, to kind of let the characters just be side by side. And sometimes he's just letting you see a cruelty happen, and he's not saying, ha ha, that this cruel thing is funny. I don't think he really ever does that. In fact, that's the antithesis of who Schultz is. But he does let it happen. He does let a character do something, and he doesn't always have to step in as the god of this, of the story, and you know, and give Lucy her comeuppance in a little four panel strip. He can't.
Right. Well, you know, this is really interesting stuff and important stuff, I think. I think you will see less and less of that in the coming years. From my experience with publishers, that type of storytelling it's difficult to make understood. And it took me years of not understanding what people were even saying to me about things like this, until it finally dawned on me. It's like, oh, they think my job is to tell their kids, or these, my readers, how to behave. And to me, that would kill it. I can't be
one to think about behavior in real time, right?
Right. I want the kid to feel like I'm on their side. I'm not one more adult telling them how to behave. So when Amelia would do bad things, they would be shown as bad things. But you wouldn't hate Amelia for doing them because you have done bad things. And you would hope that she and you would just get better. And I think a kid actually does understand that. And they do understand that there are some just cruelties in life. And Schultz allows you to see those things, but they're within this much larger picture and much larger worldview that somehow it all is still okay. It's still a warm place to be, even with all the cruelness, because it encompasses so much.
Yeah. I mean, and we could talk for a long time about this, but I totally see what you're saying, Jim. And I've seen how you've extended it from what we're seeing here in Peanuts. And it's powerful, and I can't even totally put my finger on it. You've thought about it a lot more than I have, I'm sure. But the idea that you're showing characters, I mean, to me, when I see a film, I love a film where I get the sense that the god of that film, the creator of that film, if there is one, it's not a committee thing, loves all of the characters, even the villains, and doesn't necessarily love them as villains, but he loves them as people. And honors them for where they are at a given moment. And I think that in and of itself is teaching, whether you intend to teach or not. It's making a statement about how we treat people and whether we give grace to people and whether we, you know, allow a person to be where they are in a given moment. And if you're not allowed to do that because you're told we have to judge this character, and the author, the god of the story, has to judge that character on the spot, that is limiting.
Right.
And it limits, I think, the psychological depth and the emotional depth of what you can do in a story and how much you can affect somebody in a deep way. That's much, much richer than saying, yeah, this person's being bad now, and we have to point out that this person's being bad, and we all have to not like this person.
Yeah. Yeah. It also comes from the fact that people expect things, their entertainments, to flow a certain way. One of the great tragedies of discourse about art is when people started referring to story arcs instead of stories. because they sort of think, well, it has to hit this point and then this point and then this point and then I'm done because I've had the satisfying experience that they've had 15 million times before.
Yeah.
Schultz isn't interested in that.
Yeah, and that they can judge the story based on the idea of the arc. Yeah, I mean, a classic example of this concept is in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, you know, my favorite film. Mr. Potter, the evil banker who's causing so much pain and suffering in the town of Bedford Falls. The last we see of him is Jimmy Stewart, who's just come back from not existing, running to his window and banging on the windows and saying, "Merry Christmas, Mr. Potter." That's the last we see a character interacting with this guy. And I love that. And I've heard people say, no, uh-huh. He's got to get his comeuppance. There's no resolution to this character. I think, yes, there's a resolution, and it's a transcendent resolution that it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter that he's still got his money.
Right.
That's the whole point. You don't have to have a whole bunch of people like in the Saturday Night Live version where they go off with pitchforks and stakes and, you know, to beat him up. It's like, no, you're missing the whole point if that's where you go with a story like that. But arcs do, a typical idea of an arc for a story would kind of say, well, you got to resolve that in a different way. It's like, no.
Right. And it's like, well, that's a loose end. And it's like, no, it's not. But that's okay. I always think someone wrote me about a question they had in Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. And they said, am I missing something? I just wrote back, yes. October 14th. Snoopy is sitting under a sparse, thin tree. A question mark is above his head as he looks up into the air. Slowly, a leaf falls. Snoopy growls at it as the wind blows it away. He chases after it, barking the whole time. Then he makes one last dive for it, smashing into a picket fence. The leaf comes to rest on the other side of the fence, and Snoopy is disappointed.
Now, I picked this because this is another facet of Schultz's genius. He does these leaf strips, falling leaf, interacting with the characters for years. I think you could do an entire book of leaf strips, and they're generally wordless.
Yeah.
If you gave me 10 years, I couldn't come up with one. And it's really beautiful because it's, you know, sometimes the strip gets wordy, but these generally are just little ballets. And I don't know. I think maybe later in the strip, he has the leafs thinking something, which seems wrong to me. But I really love these leaf strips.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
The lettering, again, just gorgeous.
Yeah, that arf is gorgeous on the second tier, and that wham in the last tier is absolutely beautiful. And there we are seeing those motion lines above and below the leaf in the first panel where we see the leaf, and then just above it in the next one. It's like Zen cartooning.
October 17th, Linus is sitting holding a blanket up to his cheek. Charlie Brown looks on. I don't get it, he says. He inspects Linus in the blanket closer. Then Charlie Brown asks Lucy, why does Linus sit around all day holding that blanket? Lucy answers, it gives him security and happiness. Didn't you have a blanket when you were little, Charlie Brown? She tugs the blanket out from Linus and says, here, feel how soft it is. It's called outing flannel. Charlie Brown inspects it. Outing flannel? Now he's holding it up to really get a good look at the blanket. Charlie Brown says, you mean if I hold this next to my cheek all day, I'll be happy? Lucy says, insanely happy. Charlie Brown dumps the blanket on top of Linus's head, saying to Lucy, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard. Charlie Brown leaves the house and goes walking away. Still, I could use a little security. Charlie Brown walks up to the counter at a dry goods store, where we see an adult at the counter. Charlie Brown says, 1 yard of outing flannel, and don't laugh.
This is an important addition to the legend of Linus, because we now know what his blanket is made of, and that's very important. Also, Jimmy mentioned that we see an adult standing at the dry goods store. We actually see his hands, maybe her hands. So he hasn't quite violated the no adults rule.
Well, there's a ring on the finger, so that's kind of specific, right?
Yes, it is a married person at the dry goods store.
Okay.
One of the things that really strikes me in this strip is that there's this secondary thing going on in the strip as Charlie Brown and Lucy are talking about the flannel and he goes off and buys it, is the abuse of Linus and the total disregard for him. They're pulling the blanket away from Linus while his tongue is sticking out as he's trying to hang on to it for dear life. And then Charlie Brown now has completely taken it away from him, and Linus is sitting far away with a frown on his face. And when Charlie Brown rejects the idea and calls it stupid, he dumps the blanket on Linus's head, and there's a little exclamation point coming out of Linus. That just that whole disregard for the younger kid in the room is just really unique. That he's playing this whole thing. It's not part of the gag itself. It totally was unnecessary, but he has it in there. Unnecessary for the gag, I'm saying.
He does that a couple times. He's done that more and more as the years progress. There's a strip from a few months ago that we didn't really talk about, but you know, the punchline is whatever it is, it's Charlie Brown is playing baseball. And the joke is up at the top, independent of the fact that there's another joke playing out visually where Charlie Brown is looking up, waiting for a fly ball, and a ground ball goes by him without his even noticing. And I'd seen that strip many, many times and really didn't even notice that there was a second whole visual bit of business going on. He seems to be really into doing that.
Yeah, it's like his world is expanding. These characters all have different attitudes and opinions, and he's familiar with it, and he's not uncomfortable kind of weaving that in to particularly a Sunday.
October 29th, Schroeder is talking to Patty. He's holding up a sheet and says, "This is the outfit I'm going to wear on Halloween." He puts it over his head. Patty says, "It might be kind of chilly that night." Schroeder, now decked out as a ghost, walks away and says, "I can always put on a jacket." Patty looks at him as he comes back in with a winter coat over his sheet. Patty says, "Somehow that seems to spoil the effect."
And I just like this one because it's such a funny little sight gag of this sheet with a nice little jacket on over the sheet with no arms coming out of the jacket. It's just a really cute, funny sight gag, and that Schultz is very good at.
Well, and I feel this strip deeply because I was a Halloween enthusiast as a kid, and I remember very clearly for Halloween 1978 wanting to go as Luke Skywalker. And I had my Nana make me my very own Luke Skywalker costume, because this was, you could not buy Luke Skywalker anything, right? So she made this for me, and it was amazing. I was so excited and so happy for it. But my mom was intense, and I think it was a little chilly that night. So she said, "You have to wear a coat." I'm like, "I'm not wearing a coat."
Oh, no.
So she made me wear a turtleneck underneath the Luke Skywalker outfit. So now I just look like some weird kid with an ascot and a smoking jacket. Then she decided, "Well, it's windy. You have to wear a hat." I'm like, "I'm not wearing a hat." So my other grandmother had given me this helmet. It was a Star Trek helmet. You could Google this. It's rated as one of the worst like licensed products of all time. It's just a white motorcycle helmet with a giant red siren light on top, and the letters that spelled across Spock on it. So it wasn't even Star Wars, it was Star Trek. So my mom just took a piece of paper and wrote Luke Skywalker on it and stuck it to the front of the helmet. And that was my Halloween costume.
Wow. And that was pre-posted.
So talk about spoiling the effect. November 30th. Charlie Brown is walking down the sidewalk. He spies a little girl he hasn't seen before. Charlie Brown says, "Ahem, you're new around here, aren't you?" He reaches out his hand in friendship and says, "My name is Charlie Brown. All my friends refer to me as good old Charlie Brown." The little girl, who has a very loud voice as indicated by her bold lettering style, says, "That's what my friends call me too." "Huh?" asks Charlie Brown. The little girl says, "Good old Charlotte Braun." Charlie Brown says, "Oh no."
This is the second big misstep of the year after the golf tournament. Schultz doesn't introduce very many characters. And usually when they come in, they might be sort of a one joke bit and then they evolve. This was a character who supposedly her name was funny and who talked loud. And that seemed to be the entire thing. These were never reprinted, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
So we're going off the Fantagraphics collection, which has everything. So I'd never seen these before. It's, yeah, there's just nothing funny about this. And I think Schultz realized that. So she appears a few times next year in 55, and then she's gone forever into that magical place with Shermie and the other ones.
This was actually worse than I remember it. And here's why. In my mind, from the last time I read these strips, Charlotte Braun looked exactly like Charlie Brown, but like in drag. And that's actually kind of a funny idea. But when I looked back at it this time, it's like, no, she's just a little girl. I mean, she has a similar shaped head, but there's the facial features aren't the same and her body type isn't the same. So it really is just that she has a similar sounding name to Charlie Brown and she's loud.
Yeah. No, I think Harold should answer the philosophical question of where do Peanuts characters go when they disappear?
Well, I don't have the answer to that, but I do have, this was a courtesy of, I believe it was the Schultz Museum website and the Library of Congress, which has a letter from Charles Schultz to a complaining reader who apparently was somewhat, I'm just guessing, we don't have the original letter, at least I haven't seen it, that was written complaining about Charlotte Braun, how she should be basically dropped from the roster. And it gives a little bit of insight into Schultz, where he was willing to go with a reader. I'm assuming this was a playful, snarky letter given his response, but this is what he wrote back to the person who did not want to see any more of Charlotte Braun. He said, "I am taking your suggestion regarding Charlotte Braun and will eventually discard her. If she appears anymore, it will be in strips that were already completed before I got your letter or because someone writes in saying that they like her. Remember, however, that you and your friends will have the death of an innocent child on your conscience. Are you prepared to accept such responsibility?" And then he does a little drawing of Charlotte Braun at the bottom with a gigantic axe in her head.
Oh,
look it up.
My gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Great. And she's just kind of standing there impassive.
Can you imagine getting that back?
Well, it's in the Library of Congress, so somebody thought much of that letter probably was on her conscience the rest of her life. There was never another Charlotte Braun.
Well, it's really funny. And look, it's so great to hear from readers, but every once in a while, you have to answer back with a little bit of snark to save your sanity.
I don't think snark was invented until the 70s.
Well, I get the sense from Schultz that he liked someone who could pull something out of himself that he normally wouldn't share. He couldn't share that in the strip itself. He was so conscious of his audience and his editors and everybody involved. There's this balance that he has. But in this personal correspondence, again, I'm guessing that the letter he got just had a vibe to it, that he felt free to do that, and that he probably very much enjoyed sending that letter. It just shows another side of him that I think is pretty fun.
To answer your philosophical question, Michael, is that they go nowhere because space-time is a four-dimensional solid. You block it. December 19th. Linus is playing with some toys. Lucy walks in with a scowl on her face. "Hey," she yells. Linus knows what's coming. Lucy starts picking up the toys and says, "Give me those toys." She gathers everything together and storms out, saying, "Everything's mine. Mine, mine, mine." Linus sighs, defeated. Lucy walks back in and nonchalantly flips him one solitary rubber band, saying, "Here, I guess you can have this rubber band. Have fun with that." Linus looks at it for a moment, and then there's three panels of him blissfully and utterly joyously playing with the rubber band. Lucy comes back in, even angrier, saying, "What's going on here?" She snatches back the rubber band. "Give me that." As she walks away, she says, "I didn't mean for you to have that much fun."
Yeah, I love this strip. It's Linus in his first year of existence was nonstop frustration. He's just unable to get anything he wants. Nobody's paying attention to him. He just can't connect with anybody. And then this year, toward the end, we're at least seeing that he's finding some of his own happiness, even though sometimes it is short-lived. And this is just a really great strip showing that Linus can overcome his circumstances. He's finding ways to find that happiness on his own, even if he's still disconnected sometimes with his friends and his older sister.
Another great bit of drawing in this strip. The drawings of him playing with the rubber band are just so much fun. And my favorite drawing of the whole strip is the expression on Linus's face in the last panel, which I'm not exactly, it's a very complex little expression that he's a little upset that Lucy took the rubber band. He's a little dazed because he was just blissing himself out with the rubber band. And he's a little proud that he kind of got her goat.
Yeah, he's kind of, it's weird. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interpretations on that. My two favorite drawings in this, the one when he's full tilt playing with, I don't know, he has probably about 14 hands as he's stretching the rubber band every which way. And he has this total triumphant joy on his face. It's just delightful. But then the other drawing that really hits me is the second to last one. It's this little look of his open mouth as he's have, it's almost like it's from some Pietà. I don't know. It's like this.
It is. Yeah. This it does have a Renaissance posed kind
like
of feel.
Something has taken away and he is the innocent who has had it taken away and he's holding his arms out. It's like this thing that has been removed from him I don't know why that little simple drawing is really powerful.
All right, guys, so that's 1954. How do we sum that up?
That's a major step forward with a couple of little baby steps backward. He's definitely solidifying. This is a year that the Sundays really shine. Almost everyone is great.
Yeah.
And we'll see this progression continue.
Harold, what do you think?
It's a great year. It really more and more feels like the Peanuts that I remember growing up, which means a lot of the stuff from the 50s, 60s, and 70s in particular. I lived kind of in the 60s and 70s, but this is the kind of stuff that I remember of Peanuts. The characters are there. Their personalities are coming out. And he's loosening his style up this year. I think he's moving toward a little freer artwork. And it's just a great year. There's so many wonderful things in it, and he's moving away a little bit more from doing traditional gags, and is just playing off of these rich characters he's developing.
Yeah, you know, it's fully Peanuts. It's beautiful. It's funny. My biggest takeaway from the last couple episodes is my shock at how good the Sundays are and how quickly they get that good. He just had a knack from it almost from the very, very beginning. And
definitely,
they're some of the funniest and some of the best drawn comic strips I've ever seen. And, you know, where I want to leave 1954, guys, is we have spent an inordinate amount of time busting on the golf tournament. But something happened during the golf tournament that we did not mention. And it's an historic moment in the history of Peanuts. Do either of you know what it is?
No idea.
No.
It is the first appearance of the name Van Pelt.
Oh my God.
So we find one of the things I think is going to be interesting as we move forward is that sometimes, and even in the lowliest nooks and crannies of this masterpiece, there's something really cool and really great if you take the time to look. So
start to see the Dutch influence.
You got to see the Dutch influence. All right, guys, this has been great. This has been 1954 in Peanuts. If you want to, you know, continue with the following along and getting involved in the conversation, why don't you check us out on our social media accounts? We are Unpack Peanuts at both Instagram and Twitter. Also, go to the website, unpackingpeanuts.com, where you can find old episodes and where you can also vote for your strip of the year. Speaking of strip of the year, guys, your nominees for strip of the year 1954.
I'm going with the classic Lucy, January 24th, where she's having a tantrum, running around, destroying everybody's fun, and ends up with her running from an angry mob And she says she's frustrated and inhibited, and no one understands her.
It's a great strip. Harold?
I was going to do Linus and the Rubber Band. That was going to be my nominee. But at the last minute, having gone through all of these, I think I'm going to switch that over to March 21st with Charlie Brown making the sandcastle and Patty just destroying it with glee and Charlie Brown winding up in bed sighing. It's just so uniquely Charles Schulz. This is like, I think, it really takes your breath away when you read it, when you see what has happened to Charlie Brown because of this act of careless cruelty. It's so Charles Schulz, and it's not typically the kind of strip that I dwell on too much, but this one really, really hit me.
So my takeaway is that I am tired of going last picking strips of the year because I always have to adjust my picks based on one of your guys. That would have been my pick. As it is, though, I'm going to go with the classic Sunday strip from July 11th. It's a bug. It's a bug. It's a piece of fuzz. It's just funny. I defy anyone to find a panel per panel funnier comic strip in the whole decade of the 1950s. It's really good.
Yeah, and that would make a good band name, actually. If you're looking for a band name, it's yours.
Hey, that should
it's
be something.
Bug, it's a bug. It's a piece of.
We could track that. Yeah, anytime something comes up in Peanuts, that would be a good band name. We'll have to call that out. I have so much fun doing this podcast. I hope you have fun listening to it. We get to hang out with pals and talk about the greatest comic strip of all time. So why don't you come back and join us again next week? Till then, I'm Jimmy. From Michael and Harold. Be good.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!